are back with episode 568 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I guess with the Americans dominating Fleetwood Mac, that's why the machine chose Pink Floyd.
And this is Bronson from Australia, and I gotta say, this episode was a bomb.
And, well, talk about a good fight for the top three here. We have all episodes that just, well, left us reeling and wondering who to trust. No, seriously, like wondering exactly who we're supposed to trust here. Anyway, we are going to be talking about the top three for the week and then the bottom three for the week. But before we do any of that, Edmund, you need to give the standard disclaimer.
Absolutely. As always, we will discuss just about anything that we feel like in these episodes. So if you haven't watched, you will be spoiled. But as always, we try and give you a week or so before we do that to you.
That's right. And we are going to start off with our number three show for the week. And this one, there are no actual quote-unquote promos, so we'll just get right into it. And that is Daredevil, Season 1, Episode 5, World on Fire. Funny, that's the show that we were just talking about at the end of last show. Anyway, Fisk advances his plans to rip Hell's Kitchen apart. Meanwhile, Murdoch and Foggy help tenants victimized by a slumlord. This episode came in at an average of 8.58, so quite well above average here. But we have a really, wide variety of opinions. We go all the way from a top score of 9.5 all the way down to an average 7 from Gary. And he just kind of said very generally enjoying the continuing buildup of supporting characters. But I do know he has not been particularly happy with the portrayal of Kingpin, which has been holding him back. I know he mentioned that last week, if I'm recalling correctly. So, but Bronson, you and Edmund gave this one a 9. So Bronson, why don't you get us started off here?
Much like the previous episode, we had a real great focus on Fisk and continuing to explore what makes him such a really interesting villain. Just that fantastically counterintuitive portrayal of someone who should be sort of a, you know, big and bad, large and in charge, all those kind of things, stuff like that. And like, no, he's just so childlike. There's a serious case of arrested development gone on with this guy, that you can see him trying so hard to overcome at all times, that just makes him really compelling. And the only times that he does seem to overcome it is when he just completely loses it, as we saw in the previous episode. So yeah, I loved the furthering of that. I just thought it was great. You also get a bit more of his more conniving side as he's dealing with the Russians putting the blame for certain things, you know, back on the vigilante. So yeah, it's great. And then meanwhile, in the on the Nelson and Murdoch side of things, you've got a bit more of that legal procedural aspect. And it could be very procedural. It could be very formulaic. But no, they find a good way to tie everything into the main plot. They use it as a way to establish character and of everyone at the office of everyone on that side of the thing. Which is this was just such a great character driven episode, and then at the very end the plot really kind of kicks in hardcore. It's been there the whole episode, but it's just sort of been simmering away under the surface, and then suddenly it just sort of, you know, explodes out at you. it was a great I can see why, because when they sent out screeners of Daredevil to reviewers and whatnot, they sent the first 5 episodes, and I can see why, because 5 is a great culmination of all the things I've been seeing up previously.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah.
Bit by bit, the show has been going through and sort of dealing with. Okay, let's show you and give you a really good sense of Murdoch, of Matt. Let's give you a good sense of the office. Let's give you a good sense of Kingpin. Let's give you a good sense of what's happening in the city. And this is where it all really starts to tie into one another.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, this was for me, I think, the same way that you feel the culmination of these various subplots and you see how they start to connect. But particularly when those bombs go off, that is everything that happened in the first 5 episodes coming to fruition in a very big way. And it is really in the sense of your kind of 3-act type of formatting, you could almost feel like that's the end of your first act. that, yep, introduction's done. Now we're into the meat of the story after this. Things inevitably shift after this point.
But it never felt, in the run-up to this episode, it never felt like, okay, you need to give us this so we can set things up and we'll eventually get to the real proper story. No, it's all felt very, very rich and everything, and very very, very meaty, very fantastic up to this point. This just kind of kicked it up to the next level. It's not necessarily a huge jump, but it just represents like a big tying together of all the aspects of what they've been doing.
Mm-hmm. Edmund, what would you add to this?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I got that sense both of the sort of culmination aspect of all of these different elements that they've been introducing coming together, and also just the fact that it is the Kingpin making this big, really his first big power move. I certainly agree as well. I mean, this was continuing that whole. Wonderful sense of just of basically being dropped in this story and feeling like you've just been dropped into watching a bunch of real people going through their lives and just the way they managed to avoid that sense of setup never got that feeling of no, they're just going through the checklist of all the people they needed to introduce to get the story going. It was just no, we were dropped into this story and are getting to know these people, and it's a remarkably organic achievement.
Definitely. I don't have the issues with the Kingpin for reasons that you said, Brunstone. I think that I don't know if it was you or someone else who brought up the fact that the Kingpin seems almost like someone who maybe has a mild Asperger's to him, where
I don't know if I said that to you, but yeah, that's very much part of the vibe I get off him. Like he's somewhere on the spectrum. Like he can't quite, like, you look at the way that D'Onofrio plays him, it's like he doesn't like making eye contact. He has to be very deliberate about the way he speaks, otherwise he sort of gets off point and whatnot. It's the way he conducts himself socially, the fact that he hates going outside and being with other people and whatnot. It's a great that's a really strong comparison to make. I don't think you'd be wrong,
and it would kind of fit in the sense that he considers everything that he's doing as a necessary means to an end. This is how he's solving the problem, because he wants what Matt wants. And that's one of the things that I think is different from the traditional Kingpin, where he's just a villain that wants to control the city or control everything. He's your typical underground thug almost. Here, he is someone who wants to restore the city to its former glory, Hell's Kitchen anyway, and this is his way of doing it. And it just so happens that his single-minded way of getting that done clashes with, good moral fortitude, I guess. But, Matt has a very different way of doing it. I still love the fact that this is all the inevitable fallout of the Battle of New York. I love that connection that they made to that. But anyway.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really strong thread, because it's not just a fan service-y kind of, how do we tie what into what? But it also, like, it really sets up the whole premise. Like, you wouldn't have even a fraction of what you have in the show if it didn't exist in that universe in a really tangible way.
Mm-hmm. Anything more to say about this one, Edmund?
Yeah, I just want to go mention about the Kingpin, and I meant to bring it up in an episode or two ago, but I do find it very interesting that they have made this as much an origin story for the Kingpin as for Daredevil. And I have wondered if some of the reaction against the portrayal is people who really want to see sort of that or are used to seeing that fully formed crime boss Kingpin from the comics, and here they're kind of showing how he got there, but he's not really there yet. Season or two may start looking like more like the Kingpin that they're used to, but he's still got to grow into that role.
What's interesting here is that, I'm sorry, I'll get to you in a second, Brunson, but Kingpin is typically a Spider-Man villain that was kind of brought into Daredevil's story later down the road. What will be interesting to see is that now that Spider-Man is going to be connected to the MCU is whether or not they feel like pulling him into Spider-Man's films at some point, in any way, even a small you know, cameo role or background role to, like you said, maybe a few seasons down the road, it goes from this origin story to something bigger, to being that crime lord behind the scenes, mm-hmm. then it might make sense for him to be involved with someone. Like, again, this is where he feels like, here's this element that is now getting involved in my city and messing things up, you know, who knows. But it occurred to me that, hey, you know, now we're actually able to connect these things where before we couldn't.
Yeah, they apparently they were a bit frustrated when they learned just before the season went to air that they'd gotten the Marvel, that they'd gotten the Spidey rights, which meant that they'd gotten the rights to use the Daily Bugle, which is the newspaper that Ben Urich works for in the comics and that. As for some of that, you're right about I've done a bit of reading in this. You're right about Kingpin originally being a Spider-Man villain, but he became much more well known and much more entwined with Daredevil, mm-hmm. To the point that with these character rights bundles that happen, like when a studio would you know, if they bought the rights to Daredevil, those rights would include characters like Foggy Nelson, Karen Page.
Uh-oh. Nope. A little lag again. But at any rate, I think we know the point that he was trying to make, so hopefully he will be right
Page,
back.
Oh, there Elektra, we go. Bullseye, and Kingpin.
Right. Okay, so while we wait for the lag to kind of catch up, but yeah, definitely I can see that how that would play into it in that I also was kind of concerned when Ben was not involved with the Daily Bugle, but we'll see. Brunstone is having a little bit of connection issues. So what we're going to do then is move on over to the next show, which, just beat out Daredevil by a hair this week. And this would be Arrow. And here's the promo.
Oliver Queen is dead. He has been changed.
He's under some sort of league mind, literally.
There was a rival. What is it you wish me to do?
He will come for me.
There's only one thing left of him now. Us.
You must eliminate this threat.
Arrow. All new this Wednesday at 8, 7 Central on the CW.
All right. And Bronstam, are you back with us?
Hope so.
Okay. Can you do the recap for Arrow?
Alrighty, just give me one tick. Okay, Arrow Season 3, Episode 21. Oliver goes through a rigorous transformation. Meanwhile, the League of Assassins come after Nyssa, and she arms herself to face them alone, but Laurel asks Felicity and Diggle to help protect her.
That's right, and like I said, this one came in just a hair ahead of Daredevil at an average of 8.6. Now, let's see. I gave it a little bit higher on the rank than some of you did, but Gary gave it an 8.5, and his comment was, "Nice tense episode. The constant Oliver wouldn't do." Something can go right there.
Yeah, no. I think he's saying there should be a couple of punctuation marks in there, but no, the constant Oliver wouldn't do that has gotten tedious.
That makes a bit more sense.
That does make a little bit more sense. I was. This is what happens when we jot down notes quickly. I know he was running off to vacation. So at any rate, in the meantime, we have. This episode was the one where we basically got Oliver making decisions about his future with the League of Assassins, and I really liked Oliver in this episode a lot. But at any rate, Nadim gave it a 9 as well, and his main point was that he gave it that on the premise that, or the assumption that Oliver was completely playing a role here, and I think that he would be very upset if that didn't turn out to be the case. So I to my point, or at least on my part, I don't think it mattered for the episode itself. I think that it would add another layer to it, but the episode was enjoyable just on the level of what it was presenting the characters, which was this possibility that brainwashed, actually, you know, completely convinced or trying to, you know, play a part here, Oliver was having to be the heir to the demon, and boy, did he commit. Edmund, what would you add to or say about this one?
Yeah, no, that I certainly agree with you that, that yes, it doesn't really matter whether he's playing them or has in fact been brainwashed. But one thing I thought was particularly well done in this was the emotional resonances between certainly the feelings of the team as they're whiplash back and forth between whether Oliver's with him or against him, but then in particular for the secondary characters, certainly I thought the sort of mutual murder / suicide sacrifice was a particularly poignant end to that whole arc, and even though at times it seemed like the flashbacks haven't necessarily been meshing up as well as they have at other times during the series, certainly in this one with it finally bringing us to the end of the tale of their young son and exactly what had been happening with them running around running around Hong Kong was finally meshing up. So I thought that was a particular highlight.
Bronstone, what would you add to that?
Well, I'd go back a bit to to what you were saying about Nadim's review and his comment. I took this episode within the maybe first 10-15 minutes of it. The way that I was started thinking of it was just like, oh, I think Ollie's actually probably gone bad, and I was I was sort of having flashbacks of season 6 of Buffy. The idea that we're going to get to the end of the season and through all of what's happened, we're going to learn that, no, one of our heroes is going to wind up being the big bad who has to be defeated in the end, which I love, which is just it's a great idea for what to do with this story, with this season, with this character. And it ties in well to what we saw in the middle of the season where Ollie goes away because he's dead and everyone has to figure out how to keep being – you know, superheroes and whatnot without him around to lead them. And then he comes back and there's a bit of friction as the, what they've figured out how to do compared to what he would want to do and stuff like that. And then we got to deeper into the Ra storyline and he finally became a decent character and we got to see a bit more of him. But now it's looped back around to the thing of like, okay, yeah, now all the secondary characters have to band together. They have to be the heroes and they have to protect the city from Ollie. I just thought this is an insanely interesting way to take the story. And a very different thing to do with the character. They're not just following the same plot structure as they have in the previous two seasons, and like they're doing this season on the Flash. I mean, as much as I love that idea of like you spend the whole season building up the villain and eventually getting to the showdown, it's like they kind of did the same thing. You know, they've done that same storyline a few times, and I like it, but I love that they're doing something different here. And what's more, it helps redeem some of the previous episodes that I thought were a bit lacking because Ra's al Ghul wasn't nearly as strong a bad guy as we'd had with Malcolm Merlyn or with Slade. And it's because my going back and looking at previous bits of this season in a more favorable light, it really started in the episode where it's just like, no, I don't want to kill you. I want you to succeed me. That's where I kind of began to flip, and this really cemented it of just like, okay, now that I see what they're doing over the course of the season, things that I wasn't as fond of at the time seem much better.
Hmm. Yeah, I can see that.
Hello, hello.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. Apparently, it's just John.
Yeah. There's. I thought I'd actually opened a window, like something had opened on my desktop. Because just all of a sudden, it's the, I don't know how to dance to dubstep.
Yes. No, John, we still can't hear you.
No, John, we still can't hear you.
And we're getting horrible lag.
Okay.
Hello.
That was interesting.
That's a bit better.
Yeah. All right, well, hopefully you guys are still talking about Arrow in the meanwhile.
No, we're having too much fun listening to your dance tracks.
Okay, then. Well, what can I say? Ra's al Ghul has an awesome discotheque right underneath of Nanda Parbat. Anyway,
I thought R2-D2 would put out a single.
Thank you, Skype, for that wonderful thing. Anyway, moving on then to our number one show for the week. And this one is, well, now we understand. It wasn't that it was anything related to the League of Assassins. Samaritan clearly did not want us to get any further in this episode, but too bad. We're going to power our way through. Number one show this week, Person of Interest, and here's the promo.
Get in the game.
It was created to protect us.
The machine is dying.
Now, will they give their lives to save the machine? Don't miss the explosive season finale.
Can't hold off an entire army.
We'll die trying. We're the machine's last hope.
New Person of Interest, CBS next Tuesday.
All right, and Edmund, if you don't mind.
Certainly. This is Person of Interest, Season 4, Episode 22, YHWH. In the Season 4 finale, Finch and Root race to save the machine, which has been located by Samaritan, and Reese is caught in the middle of the final showdown between Elias and Dominic.
Mm-hmm. And we have an average here of 9, mm-hmm. so in the exceptional range for sure. And we all gave this a 9. So Edmund, why don't you get us started off here? What was the thing that you loved about this episode the most?
Well, obviously there's sort of the twin tracks that have been building all season and coming to a head. The sort of crime war, which is between Elias and Dominic, and of course the ongoing cat and mouse game between the machine and Samaritan, Certainly, for the crime war front, I guess my main happiness was just that they were winding it up, because you know I think all three of us have had our issues with the introduction of the Brotherhood and Dominic and actually, I mean, now that I think about it, I mean pretty much any crime element since the original introduction of Elias.
Yeah, this is leave it to Daredevil, guys. Focus. You get another team to deal with the New York level street crime, and we'll focus on stopping the evil artificial intelligence from taking over the world.
Yes,
fair enough. I mean, you don't see Daredevil taking on Operation Insight. You don't see, you know, Captain America taking on the Kingpin. So yeah, good point. Not that I would ever put the Kingpin and Dominic on the same level. That was the problem.
God no.
Nothing made me happier than when he was taken out. It was just that we had to have Elias, may he rest in peace, go as well. Yeah. But I think it was
the right move with Elias. He either needed to come into the fold, or he needed to go away. And yeah. I don't know. Mind you, by the same token, they also need to do that with Fusco already. I mean, he's been out of the loop for way too long, and especially if they are putting the crime element of the show, like the New York street crime element of the show, if they're putting that to rest, then they're going to need to do that. Otherwise, Fusco is just going to become completely irrelevant. Wow.
I see that happening early next season, because otherwise it doesn't make any sense. But yeah, I agree with you. They've kind of put to bed this whole street level stuff, basically, because unlike in the MCU, Samaritan got to implement Operation Insight and is taking out all of the people threatening its notion of peace. And anyone who has seen what other artificial intelligences do when they decide, I'm going to do what is necessary for the good of the peace of the world. Yes. That could go very wrong as well. So there's a bit of a larger issue to be dealt with now if the machine is, basically talk about good foreshadowing, stuck on a hard drive in a briefcase. Yeah, I think they're about as low as they've ever been. I thought they were in a bad situation at the end of the third season.
the only way that they could have made this more both appropriate and dire would have been if Shaw turned up with a robot arm saying, "Why the hell do you keep calling me Samin?" because that was the other reason why I thought the last episode went full on Winter Soldier. It wasn't the Insight thing. It's because of the stuff with Shaw.
Yeah, well, there's that too. That would have been pretty hilarious. No. I think that we're good. I was thinking you might have gone even completely into a different area of the Whedon-esque type of stuff and said that you were waiting for them to pan down the street and have a dragon flying at them because it was so reminiscent of the end of Angel season 5. But
let's get to work.
That's right. But yeah, boy, that ending. And I've been waiting for them to pull out the Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
This could not have been a more like hair on your arms straight up type of timing for that. I mean, it was perfect down to the beats of the conversation with the music. I thought they did a really nice job of finally melding it in there.
Yeah, they did.
But yeah, I mean, what else is there to say about this? I mean, basically control got taken out for all intent purposes. Anyone who was in the way of Samaritan is now pretty much on the run with nobody out in the artificial intelligence world there to do anything. I mean,
yeah, there's,
yeah, this is a completely no different show now.
There's no one on Team Machine's side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I thought they did a particularly good job in the way they set everything up for this end run of making you think that control that they might be able to, you know, get the enemy of my enemy as my friend with control, but then having that option taken away as well. I mean, yeah, but it was just like last season when you know they sort of played with the idea that, you know, oh no, they're always going to come out on top, and then they didn't, and then to just up the ante and you know, and stick the machine in a briefcase by the end of this one was yeah, I mean, it was hard enough imagining where they were going to go last season, and now I just really don't have any idea, but I'm just really looking forward to seeing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was one of those things where it's like, I can't believe this is the season finale, and then for it, granted, come on, we know it's going to get renewed. Yeah. They would have to be complete idiots to not renew this show.
Yeah, because when is a television network
all right
stupid with an awesome show that we love?
This is CBS. They're not exactly fast on the trigger with shows. I mean, CSI was dying years ago, and it's only now coming to a finish. And they're at least giving it giving CSI, you know, that big, highly serialized show, they're giving a 2-hour send-off to. So I would be rather just floored if they were to end Person of Interest here. And not have a 50. Yeah,
you've at least got to give us the Person of Interest Age of Samaritan movie.
There you go.
Complete with how the hell do we take our broken AI and make it awesome again?
Yes, exactly.
We're getting a bit ahead of things.
Yeah. But anyhow, any other thoughts here on this one, Bronstam?
It was a ride. Like it was just top to tail fantastic.
Edmund?
Just one of my favorite shows continuing to do its thing.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. I can't really say that there's anything more to do than wait until we see how this gets resolved. All right, we're going to have our mid-show break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some shows that were on the other end of the spectrum. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
All right, and we are back, and we are going to be talking about a few shows here that just seem to not hit the mark this time. And to be fair, they're all kind of around that average mark, not too far off. They're certainly not down in the, you know, 4 and 5 range that we've seen in the few past weeks where some shows have really misfired. But these are just the ones that aren't really making that big push here at the end of the season that you usually see shows make. And they're just wound up on the bottom three here. And the first one on the list coming in is Orphan Black, Season 3, Episode 3, Formalized, Complex, and Costly. Lita and Castor hunt for the original clone DNA. Mark and Gracie pursue new leads to find the samples that will free them. Art and Sarah reunite to track down Mark and Gracie. Yeah. Okay, and this got an average of 7.17. So, average.
It's, plot-wise, they're revisiting what they've done in previous seasons with a twist of weeds.
Yes.
And like has happened at previous times in the series, like, even, but, you know, the plot is not necessarily engaging me, but the characters still are. Like, the plot still is. Characters who would have felt extraneous, like pointless on other shows, because they're not that involved in the main storyline, feel a lot more vital here because there's a real exploratory element to the show. Like, I mean, it's that thing, you know, we talk about, like, it could just be, you know, 6 Tatiana Maslany's hanging out and reading the phone book, and it would be fascinating and brilliant, and I'm still finding that level of fascination in what's going on. The great science fiction story has been a great bonus, kind of, for the previous couple of seasons. It's not as strong here, but I'm still finding a lot to enjoy.
I think I mentioned this last week. I still enjoy Tatiana Maslany and her various characters and their interactions, and I'm okay with that. I'm getting a little tired of the repetition of the plot, which is one of the things that you mentioned, and I'm still not... I'm just not taking to the actor that is playing the Castor clones nearly as quick or as much as I did Tatiana Maslany. I feel like...
Oh, well, he's... That guy's got a... it's a steep hill to climb, regardless.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I mean, that's where I can't in the back of my mind, I go, well, then who would you have play that? I don't think anyone would be in that enviable position trying to do that. Not to mention the fact that for a lot of people, the enjoyment was the fact that it was such a female centric show, and now it feels like this is almost in a certain sense, until they really develop it more, a little bit of an intrusion on the premise of the show. So they have to kind of sell on the fact that it's like, well, wait a second, this was really the Tatiana Maslany variety act. Now we've got this guy here, like, you know, getting involved in, what's he all about? And I don't think that they've really gotten that far enough down the road for it to feel necessary yet. If that's the right word, I don't know.
I don't necessarily think that this actor is doing a bad job. I think it's he's not as good as Maslany. He's not bad, but he's not as good. And he's never going to be able to compete just by the fact that, like, we've had two seasons of this show to get to know and love all of the leader clones. Now that the casters are coming along, they're a surprise. They're different. And stuff like that. I agree that it's they feel a bit like an intrusion, but I think that's deliberate. I mean, the whole point is that they're kind of being they strike me as being, you know, they're antagonists. Like, and to me that seems like a smart place to take the show if you want to introduce new antagonists, because the clones have become a lot more buddy-buddy with the dyad and whatnot. Who do you introduce as villainous characters? Another set of clones. The trick is, and they're still working it out, and I hope that they can nail it within the next couple episodes, but it's how do you... I don't know. I want them to find ways to use the cast of clones that aren't just retreads. I don't mind the actor. I think you could tell really, really good stories. But so far, the main thing they've done is basically just revisit a lot of the things that they've already done with the all the leader clones, but in a slightly more Drink Spiker face kind of way.
I think part of the problem is that we were introduced to the leader clones, and they were all very different in terms of personality and life situation and everything else. I mean, you don't get much different than, you know, going from an Allison to a Helena. Castor, they're all kind of versions in on the Helena theme right now. And that's, I think, part of the problem. You don't have as much range in the characters to play, so the actor isn't really getting to show that he can do that. And I think after three episodes, granted, it's only three episodes, but I think that the fear a little bit here is that they're intentionally only having that type of male clone. And that's going to be the story. So it's going to be like, oh, so it's going to be stuck in having various iterations of this one type of character with very minor differences. And that's going to probably be the biggest problem.
Yeah, hopefully. And hopefully they'll start branching out with the cast of clones very soon. I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head. It's like, yeah, we're seeing they're all in the Helena mold. We need to see casts that are more disparate. We need a chance for this actor and for this storyline to prove its worth. It's never going to, like, the casters are never going to, I don't know, they're never going to be as popular, as well-received as the leader clones, because Tatiana Maslany is just such a tour de force from the beginning. Like, it was such a surprise. It was so fresh and fantastic. The follow-up has got a, it's always going to get, marked down a little bit in comparison. But yeah, I do hope that they give this actor and this character, these characters a chance to really shine. And they haven't gotten that chance yet.
Yeah, that's been one of my main fears is as they've been spooling out the caster clones, is that I'm worried that they made a decision to not make them as differentiated precisely to put less of a burden on Ari Melin playing them, that thinking we can't ask somebody to try and pull a Tatiana on the male side. So because it seems to me they've made that they're making the caster clone sort of more purpose driven or purpose designed, where the development was much more towards the sort of ultimate soldier type. So he's not going to be as differentiated, and certainly with their 10 episode season, and it's three episodes in already. If they were going to do something with the casters on a wider range, like the original leaders, I think we would have started seeing it by now. And I'm worried that out of deference to the actor, they were kind of hamstringing the character and potentially him. But I'll keep my fingers crossed about that. But I'm definitely getting more of the sense that you two were talking about yes, I'm absolutely invested in all of the original Lita clones, and I still very much enjoy seeing their adventures. And I'm still not sure about the plottings and intricacies on this show. They are very good at the characters, but I'm still not convinced about their ability to really bring the conspiracy.
All right, let's see. I think we've said everything that we need to say about Orphan Black, but then moving on to the second of our bottom three here. Here's a show that we're not at all surprised being here, and that is Gotham, Season 1, Episode 22, All Happy Families Are Alike. In the Season 1 finale, the Gotham City gang war reaches its boiling point with Fish Mooney battling Maroni and Penguin. In other events, Barbara and Leslie Tompkins are brought together, and Bruce searches Wayne Manor for any clues as to what his father might have left behind. And this came in at an average of 7.17. I think that this episode might have been slightly more shocking if we didn't know the actress who plays Fish Mooney wasn't coming back.
Yes.
Oh, and if it wasn't Gotham. Anyway. Well, okay. Yeah. Edmund, anything to say about this one in particular?
I wish there was more, I felt like saying. I mean, the certain stuff that was going on in here to me just seemed so indicative of the problems all season. I mean, you have this whole crime war that you've been building that you do need to bring to a head. I'm still thinking if they had really just focused more on that. And in the case of this episode, left out certain things like Barbara and Leslie having their lovely dysfunctional psychotic therapist relationship starting since that whole plot line, both in terms of Jim Gordon's relationships and then the attempt to bring in the Ogre storyline, just has certainly been some of the more problematic parts of this season.
But I will say that Barbara is so much more interesting when she's a psychotic maniac. than anything else that she's done all season long. That's not hard to beat, though.
True, yes.
You might have noticed my one comment that I made immediately after the episode when I gave it a score was meh.
Yeah.
But no, let's be fair. I will say this. Another thing that kind of bothered me is that if you are going to have Bruce in the midst of trying to understand what Lucius Fox was trying to say about his father kind of hiding his true intentions from the board at Wayne Industries or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
To have him find the staircase down to the cave.
Yes.
That's great. If you had any intention of following up on all of that and mm-hmm. having him begin his career, he's like 12. Great. He found the cave. There's nothing in there. Or there better not be, or you're really just messing with the audience. But at any rate, this show, literally, we've gone the entire season. The season finale comes in at average, and what does Gotham come in after the entire season with everybody giving it scores? It comes in at 7. It is the epitome. It is this season's paradigm for average, right here. Anyway.
Yeah. Except it's this season's version of that show that is completely average that came in with much more potential anticipation.
I suspect that the overall season rating would have been a lot lower had I continued to watch it.
It could have been
quite possibly,
and it might have been more indicative of the true nature of the show. But anyhow, our third and final entry in our bottom three is a show that has been in recent weeks whipsawing back and forth between the top three and the bottom three, and it's making my head spin. Yes. But it is Supernatural, Season 10, Episode 20, Angel Heart. Castiel tries to help Claire Novak find her mom, who has been missing for years. He feels guilty for what he did to the Novak family and wants to make amends by reuniting Claire with her mother. Mm-hmm. Well, this came in at an average of 6.67. And Bronstum, you gave it a 6. What was it about mm-hmm. this episode that brought it down that far for you?
The plot?
You're going to have to be more specific.
It was dumb. It was contrived. I feel like we're coming up on the end of the season. They should be trying to wrap together some story threads and stuff like that. Instead, we get a character piece. The plot is completely geared towards engineering a handful of character moments. And a lot of those character moments didn't come off of me. And just as a result, it means that the poor plotting, the dumb monster, all that sort of stuff like that, just didn't work at all for me. Now, there were a few moments, like a few moments where I thought it worked well. Mm. And pretty much all of those involved Misha Collins really getting to strut his stuff, both as Jimmy and as Castiel. They were bright moments in the midst of just utter mediocrity.
It's funny. I really felt like this episode existed only because they started the plot threads around Castiel and the human family back at the beginning of the season, and they had to just wrap it up. They felt obligated. I kind of like the idea of Claire being a proto hunter. That's fine. It's kind of an interesting way for them to go here. But it was so surrounded by this saccharine nonsense, especially that part at the end where Joe and his wife are reunited in the afterlife. It was like, really? This is Supernatural?
See, that was a nice moment, I thought, because after a long time of, Cass running around in the Jimmy Novak body and stuff like that, it was, of all the ways to tie off that particular little bit, I thought they did it well. Like, it was short, it was simple, and I thought it was well acted. It could have been a very stupid. It could have been very tragic, but it winds up just being It just winds up being a much nicer moment than it had any right to be.
Yeah, I just wasn't feeling that. It felt a little bit like it was just beating you over the head with the kind of sentimental stuff. But anyway. Edmund, your thoughts on this episode? You also gave it a 7. I mean, I didn't give it a bad rating. I gave it average, so it wasn't like terrible. But I think the main thing is that it felt like such a side story when they really felt like they were ramping up on this whole, finale. But anyway. Edmund.
Yeah, it. I mean, I guess in my case, I mean, certainly I also was seeing all the sort of saccharine moments as well. But for me, it was just you know, I think this is a case of, you know, what Misha was doing as Castiel and Jimmy was enough for me to pull it up to a 7. But it was definitely a case of it needing to be pulled up by its bootstraps to get there. But also especially with all the way they'd been ramping up the Mark of Cain and Rowena and Will She Cure It, etc. This did feel a little bit odd to be stepping so far away from all of that just to wrap up this storyline.
Yeah, just didn't quite work for me for a lot of those same reasons. So anything else to say about Supernatural other than it seems like they're trying bring this season home? They just have episodes like this. And I will say this, despite all of its struggles this season, it is still coming in at an average above Gotham. It's actually coming in a little bit higher than last season. So, hey, there you go.
Yeah, I was going to say, though, if that's the best you can say about it.
it's not the downturn that it was last season. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
It's not much better, but it is at least evening out the descent. Let's see here. We're going to go ahead then and wrap this particular show up. And when we come back next time, it'll be our, wrap up for the whole week as we go through the shows that weren't in the top three, weren't in the bottom three, but fell actually in kind of that above average range in between. So until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under the Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time. Watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.